I hope Senator Case doesn't fall down the stairs. Senate will please come back to order. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, we've got some business that we can do. Let's read the messages in for right now. Messages, do we have messages from the House?
Yes.
Messages from the House.
February the 5th, 2015, from the House of Representatives. Message, third reading, passed, amended. Mr. President, the bills listed below passed the House on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. House Bill Number 77, State Employees Veteran Service Credit, ayes 58, noes 1, excused 1. House Bill Number 126, Candidate Filing Requirements, ayes 59, excused 1. House Bill Number 135, Lifetime Archery Licenses, ayes 59, excused 1. House Bill Number 136, Interstate Game Tag Exemption Meat Processors, ayes 59, excused 1. House Bill Number 155, Wheelchair-Bound Hunters Donated Licenses, ayes 59, excused 1. House Bill Number 172, Disability Placard Designation, ayes 59, excused 1. House Bill Number 177, Collection Cost for Debts Owed to the State, ayes 51, noes 8, excused 1. House Bill Number 180, Child Interviews, Neglect, and Abuse Cases, ayes 59, excused 1. House Bill Number 182, Public Assistant Eligibility, ayes 57, noes 2, excused 1. House Joint Resolution 7, Bear Lodge Project, ayes 59, excused 1. House Bill Number 112, Capital Construction Grant Eligibility, ayes 38, noes 21, excused 1. House Bill Number 121, Constitutional Convention Limitations, ayes 44, noes 15, excused 1. House Bill Number 157, Pioneer Hunting and Fishing License, ayes 29, noes 30, excused 1. Oh, I did that wrong. February the 5th, 2015, from the House of Representatives, message number 234, third reading failed. Mr. President, the bills listed below failed to pass the House third reading by the vote indicated. House Bill Number 157, Pioneer Hunting and Fishing Licenses, ayes 29, noes 30, excused 1. And House Bill Number 198, Education Compulsory Attendance, ayes 26, noes 33, excused 1. From the House of Representatives, February the 5th, 2015, message number 237, failed motion to reconsider. Mr. President, having failed a motion to reconsider by the vote indicated below, the following bill passed the House on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. House Bill Number 137, Child Custody, ayes 32, noes 27, excused 1, Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk, jacket has been sent to LSO for engrossing. February the 5th, 2015, from the House of Representatives. Message. Third reading passed. Mr. President, the bills listed below passed the House on third reading by a vote indicated. House Bill Number 122, Workers' Compensation Permanent Disability, ayes 59, excused 1. House Bill 154, Complementary Hunting License Persons with Disabilities, ayes 54, noes 5, excused 1. House Bill Number 159, Education Writing Assessment, ayes 53, noes 6, excused 1. House Bill Number 215, Community Juvenile Services Board Creation, ayes 56, noes 3, excused 1. And House Bill Number 181, Speeding Penalties in the 80-mile-per-hour Zone, ayes 58, noes 1, excused 1. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
House bills on first reading. We'll do those next. House Bill 27, first reading of the bill.
House Bill Number 27, NRC Agreement State Authorization. Pass the House on third reading, ayes 58, noes 2.
House Bill 27 is assigned to Committee Number 9, Minerals. House Joint Resolution 3.
House Joint Resolution 3, Free Roaming Wild Horses, sponsored by the Federal Minerals Resource Management Committee. Pass the House on third reading. Ayes 59, excused 1.
House Joint Resolution Number 3 is assigned to Committee Number 5, Agriculture. House Bill 21, first reading of the bill.
House Bill Number 21, Interstate Succession Adopted Children, sponsored by Representative Stubson. Pass the House on third reading, ayes 60.
House Bill 21 is assigned to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. House Bill 49, first reading of the bill.
House Bill Number 49, Confidentiality of Participants Involved in Executions, sponsored by Representative Walters. Pass the House on third reading, ayes 41, noes 19.
House Bill 49 is assigned to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. House Bill 82.
House Bill Number 82, Brewery and Microbrewery Licenses Definition, sponsored by Representative Petroff. Pass the House on third reading, ayes 60.
House Bill 82 is assigned to Committee Number 3, Revenue. House Bill 23, first reading of the bill.
House Bill Number 23, Next Generation Science Standards 2, sponsored by Representative Patton. Pass the House on third reading, ayes 39, noes 21.
House Bill 23 is assigned to Committee Number 4, Education. House Bill 73, first reading of the bill.
House Bill Number 73, Development of Education Standards, sponsored by Representative Harshman. Pass the House on third reading in an amended form. 58, ayes 58, noes 2.
House Bill 73 is assigned to Committee Number 4, Education. House Bill 75, first reading of the bill.
House Bill Number 75, Balanced Budget Compact, sponsored sponsored by Representative Barlow. Passed the House on third reading. Ayes 45, noes 15.
House Bill 75 is assigned to Committee Number 12, Rules. Reports from standing committees.
February the 5th, 2015, Mr. President, Committee Number 7, Corporation Election Political Subdivision, to whom was referred Senate File 104. Campaign reports unopposed candidates. Reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Hicks, Meyer, and Scott. No, Senator Case and Pappas, Senator Case, Chairman.
Does that clear the desk? Senator Kraft.
Thank you. Could I interrupt all this wonderful reading for a pleasure of the floor?
Please do.
Thank you so much. Fellow senators, I would like to tell you that today we have a group of ants with us. It's the Association of Non-Traditional Students from Western Wyoming Community College, which is, of course, where I am from, so I'm very proud to introduce them. They are right up there. Dr. Stacy Lynch Newberg, who is their advisor, and then Mindy Mays, Sandra Bonner, and Pete Candelaria. Would you welcome them to the Senate?
Thank you.
Are we cleared? All right. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk with that order of business. Bills on general file. Oh, Senator Scott.
Mr. President, the bill that was just, I believe, Senate File 128, Election Runoffs, was just read in. Mr. President, as amended, that bill has an appropriation in it, and in the absence of the committee chairman, I'd ask it be re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations.
We're just double-checking to make sure it was read in. The clerk, you don't think it
was
read in?
I believe it was. What?
104 was the only one read in. Mr. Majority
Okay,
Floor Leader.
I'm sorry. I thought it was.
So I think we're waiting for that. When it gets read in, we'll redo that process. Great. So we are back to that order of business of general bills on general file. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I move that the Senate resolve itself and the Committee of the Whole to discuss bills on general file.
You've all heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senator Hicks.
The Committee of the Whole will please come to order. The first bill for your consideration is Senate File 136. Will the reading clerk read the bill?
Senate File 136, Expedited EMT Licensing, sponsored by Senator Kinski. It was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, Kinski, and Von Flatren, Senator Christensen, Chairman.
There is a standing committee Amendment number one, if I can have that read in at this time.
Senate File 136, Standing Committee Amendment number one, page two, line nine.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure?
No.
Senator Christensen. I don't know if I'll find you here in a minute.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 136. There are the Standing Committee amendments. I'd move the amendment. And to further discuss the bill and the amendment, I ask you to call on Senator Kinski.
Senator Kinski.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Members of the Senate, this bill is a bill relating to expedited licensing for emergency medical technicians. We have very brief amendment. Let me go through those and consider that, and then I'll proceed to the balance of the bill. The amendment is fairly straightforward. On page 2, we have the appearance of the word reasonable twice, and contrary to our usual bent, we're going to delete reasonableness on here. And so you see on line 9 where it says the division shall prescribe reasonable rules, and again on line 22 of page 2 where it again says the division gains reasonable knowledge, the committee felt that we could presume that the rules would be reasonable and their exercise of discretion would be reasonable, and felt it was a bit of unnecessary embellishment. We didn't reduce a lot of verbiage, but we cut two out, so we regard that as progress. The bill having been moved, Mr. Chairman, I'd call for the question on the amendment.
Are you ready for the question?
Question.
Those in favor of Senator Christian's motion, when the Standing Committee of the Whole rise and report that they do, or they Standing Committee Amendment number one to Senate File number six, all the 136, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those oppose?
Chairman, on the bill as amended, thank you. This bill was brought to my attention. Excuse me, Mr.
Standing Committee number one to Senate File 136 has passed the Committee of the Whole. We're back on the bill.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. This bill was brought to my attention by our local ambulance provider that is experiencing difficulties getting criminal background checks. I championed it on that basis and subsequently found out that the Department of Health is on board with this. Knowing what we now know now, we might have broadened it to providers other than ambulances, because all sorts of caregiving firms are experiencing delays in criminal background checks. The folks at the Department of Health that regulate emergency services providers did speak in favor of the bill. We had a battalion chief from Rock Springs speak in favor of the bill, and an ambulance provider from the capital city speak in favor of the bill as well. And they educated us quite a bit on it. What's happening is the department does have rulemaking authority currently, and they are undertaking it for licensure, for expedited licensure that would consider or give comity, I think is the legal word, or reciprocity to licensure from other states, and that's moving along. That's still not going to help with what here is a very narrow situation where the department has indicators that somebody's been previously licensed or they've been previously background checked. They passed everything else they need, and here they are. They're waiting 4, 6, 8 weeks for the criminal background check to come through. So what the department is asking for, and what we're, I guess what we're seeking for, and if I'm breaching protocol, somebody jump up and let me know by mentioning the department, but what we're asking here for is rulemaking authority for just this very narrow situation, which is described on page 2, lines 9 through 13. Which is rulemaking authority for the division to prescribe rules and regulations which provide for the conditional licensure of applicants who have satisfied all licensing requirements adopted under this act, except requirements related to criminal history screenings and fingerprinting. And that is the one gap. This is a gap-fill bill in their regulatory authority. So what they're seeking is the ability to say, we've got all these other indicators that this person's ready to go to work. They've had a license in another state, or they've worked as a daycare provider or a hospital provider, whether they need back grip.
Chairman, point of order.
Yes.
I don't think we have a...
I finally did it, didn't I? That'll teach me.
We get a count. Chair rules, there is a quorum. If you'd proceed, Senator Kinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. While we have a quorum, I'll say, and with that, I would move approval of the bill. Stand for questions, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Landon.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'm sorry to hold this up. This is a great bill, and I just wanted to... commend the sponsor for bringing it. I wanted to agree with him. I think there are other opportunities in this area. Over the course of the past year, I sat down with a daycare provider or two and had some of these same sorts of issues. Had three separate meetings on student-related issues and daycare issues. So this is a great bill. I think we need to pass it, but keep our eyes open and ears open for opportunities similar to this one. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Christensen's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 136, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Senate File 136 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 95.
Senate File 95, Speed Limit, sponsored by Senator Cole. It was referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation, Highways, Military Affairs, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Anderson, O2, Johnson, Meyer, Emmerich, no, Senator Emmerich, and Senator Escobel, Senator Meyer, Chairman. It was re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Hastert, Perkins, Ross, and Wasserberger, excuse, Senator Burns, Senator Ross, Chairman.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could I have privilege of the floor, please?
Senator Peterson, you may.
Thank you. This is something I don't get to do very often, living so far away from Cheyenne. But we do have a group of great nurses from the great community college of Northwest up in Powell. If they'd like to stand and be recognized, it's Nurses Day here in the legislature. I think they're in the North and the West Gallery. Please welcome them to the Senate.
Senator Hastert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. May I privilege the floor?
Senator Hastert, you may.
Thank you. And while we're introducing the nursing students, we have a fine group from Western Wyoming Community College behind you. I'd like to welcome them to the Senate.
Back on Senate File 95, Senator Coe.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that's a motion by the chairman of committee number 8.
Just do it.
Oh, speed limits. Oh, okay.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move the committee to hold rise and report that do so with a do pass motion on Senate file 95, speed limits. And I would refer to the good senator from up there in the northwest part of the state to explain the bill.
Huh? Senator Coe.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Members of the Senate, I bring for your consideration Senate File 95. Last year in this body, we dealt with some speed limits on the interstates. And what this bill does, Mr. Chairman, is allows the Department of Transportation, at their discretion, to raise some of the speed limits. Don't have to raise them all, but to raise some speed limits on some of the two-lane highways that are wide open with very little traffic on them. And I, like everybody else here, we drive a lot, and we drive a lot on two-lane highways. And if you live up in the northwest corner of the state where I live, I have to drive 210 miles to Casper to even find an interstate. So what I'm proposing in this bill, Mr. Chairman, is that the superintendent, after doing a traffic study, can go out and consider designating some of these two-lane highways from 65 up to 70. If you look on page 2, you'll see where it gives the discretion. On lines 8 through 10, superintendent may designate higher maximum speed limits if they, through a study, determine that it's safe and reasonable to do that. So you see over on page 3, that's where he can actually consider raising the speed limit on some of these wide-open two-lane roads from 65 to 70. Now, some of the roads would qualify and some might not. Now, if you live where I do, if you ever driven Matisse to Thermopolis, it's a beautiful road with passing lanes, not a lot of traffic. But as we all have, we've all driven 59 from Douglas to Gillette, and that probably wouldn't qualify. Other roads that might qualify, for the benefit of the good chairman up there, if you ever drove from I-80 down to Bags, that might qualify. So, Mr. Chairman, that's what the bill does. Gives the discretion totally to the superintendent to do that. And this is not Senate File 70 raising the speed limit to 95. This is Senate File 95 raising the speed limit to 70. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be more than happy to answer questions.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question. When we did the 80 miles last year, there was some concern and discussion about whether or not the way our law sets up now, and specifically if you're in a 65 miles per hour speed zone or limit speed limit and you're going 69, then if you have your seatbelt on, you are fine, but you're also given credit for your seatbelt. Plus, if you're going, I think, 71, it doesn't go on your record and you don't have any insurance difficulties. Would this apply to here for 74 and 76 or not?
Mr. Chairman, I think it would, but I'm not totally positive. For some reason, I was thinking that there was a, and I shouldn't refer to what's going on down the hall, but I hear there's a bill that might be out there that deals with that situation through the interstate highways, and I think it comes back and addresses other speed limits as so designated.
You ready for the question? Yep. We'll go right here. Senator Emmerich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if anyone realizes that the good senator went home for lunch, so I can't accuse him of speeding, but there is an assumption there. I was a no vote in committee, and my concerns are the cost, which could be considerable, spread over several years, the extreme variability of the age and the standards of the highways that we now have. Things are a little different with the interstate. They're built all to standards, and we have some roads that are 70 years old. So we'd have to change the construction of them in some areas. I'm worried about future costs, and probably more than anything, the cost and the time, or the time savings, speed creep that occurs. So these are just points that, being a no vote, I wanted you to be aware of, and I'll not accuse you of speeding when you go to lunch, Senator.
Senator Coe.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you know, I was concerned about the fiscal note that showed up on the bill, and you all can look at that. But through the good chairman of transportation and with a discussion with the department, I'm going to bring an amendment tomorrow that would phase it in so it's not so onerous in the first year. And, you know, the fiscal note was crafted strictly as if all 4,900 miles of two-lane roads would be studied to conceivably go to 70 miles an hour. Rationally, 14A over the Bighorns, 14, 16, 20 over the Bighorns, South Pass, Togedy Pass, the other mountain roads probably wouldn't be considered. So, but, you know, roads like Lingle to Lusk to Newcastle, that straight shot on 85, probably would be considered. And I drive a lot of roads, and we all do, and I actually literally was all over the state last year, and we have some wonderful two-lane roads. As a matter of fact, they're all pretty much uniformly wide now with shoulders on them. I also drive a lot in Montana, and I can tell you, they don't have near the roads we do, and the speed limit in Montana on all two-lane roads is 70, and the death rate up there isn't any higher per 100,000 miles than it is in Wyoming. But we do have good two-lane roads that I think qualify for that. And like I say again, it would be totally the discretion of the superintendent to do any of this, any of it. And I'm going to bring an amendment tomorrow. I'm still waiting to hear from the department on the amendment that would ease the pain a little bit as we ease ourselves into what they're going to do.
Senator Dockstader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Support of this, and this is not expert or it's not scientific, but a lot of the discussions I've had with YDOT and some time on the Transportation Committee, there's already some leeway on a lot of our roads out there that allow for faster speed than what they're actually posted as. And you feel it when you drive, and this one's just a personal note. With this job here, I got a two-year-old truck. Two-year-old truck just turned 60,000 miles, so anything I can do to reduce a little windshield time and get this bill passed, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Senator Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, under the spirit of being frugal and cautious, I'm wondering if a second reading amendment from the sponsor could maybe enlist the expertise of this body to verify certain roads that could handle 70 miles an hour.
Senator Christensen, was there a question there? Senator Coe.
Mr. Chairman, it's just kind of ironic that the good senator from Teton County brings that up because the chairman of transportation and the good senator from Worland, we sat over there in the corner at that table the other day with a road map, and I had a yellow highlighter out, and we went through all the roads in the state, literally. This one could qualify, this one couldn't. So we have had a look at that.
Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Meyer's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 95, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Senate File 95 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration is Senate File 122.
Senate File 122, Vision 2020, sponsored by Senator Nicholas. It was referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Case, Driscoll, Kinsey, Landon, and Peterson. Senator Peterson, Chairman. It was re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Hastert, Perkins, Ross, Wasserberger, excuse Senator Burns, Senator Ross, Chairman.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that when the committee of the whole rises to report that do so with the due pass on Senate File 122. There are no standing committee amendments, and I would defer to the good sponsor of this bill, President Nicholas.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, the bill before you described as Vision 2020 is brought to you to begin an exercise that will take a lot of work. The amount of work will be really determined by management council. It could be a great deal. Over the course of the last 10 or 15 years, we have had the opportunity to amass a considerable amount of savings into the Legislative Stabilization Reserve account. We're now getting into the discussion of when do you deploy those funds, how rapidly, what should be the depletion rate on that money. I went back and looked at my original notes on when we created that account. My first notes show that it was going to be described as the Mineral Valuation Policy Account, the MVP account. But I think there are some things that happened on the first floor, and we said, to heck with it, we'll just call it the Legislative Stabilization Reserve Account. So that's why it's the Legislative Stabilization Reserve Account. It's our account. But people have asked good questions. When do you deploy it? I've advocated over the years that if you look into our history, if you look at the last, the 1980s boom, the legislature at that time accumulated about $1 billion into the then rainy day account. At that time, the general fund budget reserve combined spending for the biennium was about $1 billion. We're now at a spending level closer to $3 billion. What we know from the last time is that we depleted that $1 billion of reserves over the late 80s and early 90s up to about 1996. We depleted all those reserves over a long period of time. We also created other revenues by creating expending accounts. We converted the county system from a cash county system to an accrual county system. Created two accounts called Gap 1, Gap 2, and there were several movements of funds. During that time, Wyoming was the beneficiary of funds that were paid by decedents in the state, where there was at that time a sponge tax, where a portion of the federal income death tax were paid, not income, but federal death taxes were paid to the state. That was received, you'll recall, the notoriety, and it was fortunate we had that money, because had we not had it that year, we would have been looking at substantial cuts. The current run that we are on right now began about 1998, 1999, by the discovery and the determination of ownership of coal bed methane. That led to deep gas, to shale gas. And so where do we look at the future? If you look at the economic profiles of the 1990s, you'll see that every year we had rising income from the prior year. And yet if you were in the legislature during those late 1990s, mid-1990s to about 1996, 97, 98, those times, you would have believed that we were having declining revenues. Why? The reason is because during that time, inflation was outpacing the increases in revenues that we were seeing from year to year. And as a result, our revenue sources simply were not keeping up with inflation, so it felt like an annual decrease every year. I can remember fighting over, I think, one year, a surplus of about $9 million, trying to figure out how we distribute that around the state. There was very little capital construction. Our deferred maintenance was falling behind. So where are we today? We had a remarkable run up through the highest year, I think about 2008, when gas prices were at record level and we had record levels of production. What we know now, if you look at the charts that are provided to you, is that revenues are declining. We expect them to plateau and come back up. But the real question is, at what rate will they begin to ascend back up? And will we see a plateauing that's flat, one that's marginally increased, or a sharp one? But for most of us that sit here, many of us have only seen revenues at years where each time the Craig report issued, we see a large carryover surplus. Now you're experiencing a decline of that. That phenomenon may be going away. And the reason it's going away is because as you plateau, the Craig group gets more and more accurate at projecting revenues, and they're projecting modest increases. Now, I caution you to be too pessimistic. I mean, you hear, for example, there are profile sheets showing that there are substantial declines 2, 4, 6 years out. But when you look at that, you also have to remember that in our standard budget now, we have capital construction factored in, a certain level of it. We have major maintenance factored in to it, which is good. And we do not profile all our revenues. We don't profile investment income. And there are a number of things that are not profiled, so it becomes difficult when you begin looking at those sheets to know exactly what your out years look like. And frankly, I become concerned as we enter what could be a plateau state that people become jaundiced to those numbers and don't simply say, what are the warning signs and what does it mean? The economists seem to tell us, though, that we can see a continued production of minerals at our current BTU level. Coal, natural gas, and oil. They tell us, I think, that while they expect revenues to stay down, they will come back up, but not to the 2008 levels, to a much more modest level. And they tell us that to expect, with the volume of natural gas being produced around the United States, the volume of gas being excess gas being produced on the count of drilling programs designed to produce oil, that we may see a plateau of revenues, that gas prices could hang in at the same prices over a period of 3, 5, 10 years. If that happens and your revenues actually become plateaued at about the levels we're spending now, every year you're going to continue to experience double-digit inflation, at least in healthcare costs. We don't see anything that's changing that. You have education costs going up probably more than your cost of living. And we may enter into the same phenomena that we had in the 1990s. And that is, every year you come down, as you erode your excess revenues, you compress the distance between what are your operating expenses for your agencies and your revenue. And if you compress that so much that you no longer have funds for capital construction, then you begin into a serious decline in the quality of your investments around the state. Your deferred maintenance goes up, and things begin to happen. If we do not spend as much into our private sector, into capital construction, highway construction, things like that, then your construction trades, many of the families that rely on building throughout the state, they will begin to experience it. And if you begin to have pullbacks in the oil and gas industry at the same time that the state's pulling back, you could expect even more dramatic changes to your budget. One of the things that if you look back at the early 1990s, our unemployment rolls were going higher. The number of people that were going on the Medicaid rolls was higher because there were fewer people with good jobs. Our Medicare costs were going substantially higher at double digits every year. It's not hard to visualize that phenomenon coming back. So part of the question is how do you begin to prepare for that? Are these things that we can forecast? what can we do to anticipate and prepare for that? If you look back at Tax 2000, we learned a lot of things. The folks in the legislature there at that time will remember that the Management Council divided the Senate and the House into two groups. They had the expenditure groups and they had the revenue groups. Each of the groups went out to explore, one group, what are the possible revenue cuts that we could do to keep our budgets more in balance. Another group went out and said, how do we increase revenues? And as it turned out, both groups came back. One group said there is no way, no place we can cut anymore, and the revenues said there's no place we can tax anymore. But since that time, we've been in a real nice environment where we've actually created more exemptions. We've narrowed the tax base. Every time you give a new exemption, you narrow the tax base, and you essentially put the load back on the mineral industry. And you'll recall, if you read Tax 2000, that the recommendation was really there are only two sources of revenue that would generate the kinds of funds that we were looking for. One would have been a sales tax on services, and the other was an income tax. Income tax had constitutional issues just because of the construct of our constitutional provision. So it seems to me that it's time for us to go back to and do another Tax 2000 analysis. And how much work we have to do will really be determined by ourselves and by Management Council. This time, although rather than dividing up the legislature, at least the vision that I have is that subcommittees will be assigned certain tasks. The task will be to go out and identify areas where cuts could happen, try to identify and help forecast where their agencies are, so we could have the Labor Committee go out and do some examinations, we could give specific questions and have answers. We could have the Revenue Committee go out and look at revenues. We could have appropriations go look at expenditures. And we could even have subcommittees break down and look at individual agencies and really examine and come back with areas of potential cuts, areas of potential more income, and begin to forecast this. Now, in the last 3 or 4 years, we see that there are economists that have come into the business of looking at states and actually developing models of their future income, creating econometric studies of a model, if you will, of revenues. Now, we're familiar with some of these modeling. We see that in the school foundation program. We model future income, expenses, things like that. What we hope to gain from hiring those individuals is something more in-depth than you would receive from the Consensus Revenue Estimating Group, the CREG group. What we'd expect to see is a more candid view of our future years, to have a more candid discussion now, more realistic discussion of what we should be doing, if anything. In the end of the day, we'll decide whether it's simply an educational exercise. Sometimes when I think back at Tax 2000, and I think about what came out of that, because we were saved by the bell being natural gas, we didn't have to implement a lot of the recommendations. But I would submit to you that the educational exercise of what those of us that went through that exercise was very beneficial. And it's a good time to have that exercise again, where we have a combination of folks that have gone through that experience and new folks, and it's sort of the passing of the guard, if you will, of that information. I would expect that at a minimum we would come out with a statutory plan with respect to the LSRA. We would create in statute an outline, or essentially a template, of when the money can come out, how we're going to sustain money going in, how long it should last. And while it may not have the 100% agreement, it'll at least be an agreement by a majority of both houses. And at least a majority of both houses will have decided on that day what is the LSRA policy and how do we utilize those funds. Obviously, it can be changed if circumstances change, but we would have that. In the bill, we provided for a consulting group that you'll see over on page page 3 of your report. What we've asked is that we'll go out and solicit assistance from an advisory panel consisting of the governors, former governors. We have at least 4 living governors now. Each one has experienced a different time in the economy of this state. Maybe go look at former JAC chairs or even revenue chairs and bring them get back. Now, what I do not envision that they will do is be involved in the day-to-day exercise. I think these are all busy people. But I think that they may lend help, if they're willing to do it, to come in as an advisory group to say, what information should you gather? What kind of new information is available to make these decisions? And then maybe be the peer review group that we test our results from, but to give them some advice. So I think that if we limit work with them to develop a limited scope, there's a lot of knowledge there to be provided to us in terms of what should be a policy. But in the end of the day, it seems to me that there are many aspects of this that is sort of a reliving of the Tax 2000 exercise, and it's time, I believe, for the legislature, using new techniques, information of folks from the mineral industry that we can hire, economists to develop the models, and create a better scientific impression, if you will, a forecast or a map of what our economy looks like against what our tax basis is, and begin to develop a plan on how we're going to grow the state with the confines of our tax system. Mr. Chairman, that explains the bill, and I'll stand ready for questions.
Senator Bebout.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to add a little bit to that discussion, and many of us in here were over in the House when in 1998, 99, 2000, when a lot of this was going on, and many of you were here in the Senate as well. And you recall that not like what we're going through today, we saw a significant decline in our revenues, and we thought it was 1 year or 2 years. It turned out to be about 10 years. And so we put together a very similar analysis of what this bill does and what it tries to accomplish and will accomplish. What I want to share with the senators is that there were a lot of benefits that came out of that that allowed Wyoming to be ready for what happened in the next decade of 2000 to 2010 and being able to utilize the uptick in our revenues, the uptick in our mineral production, and all those things to move the state forward. And it allowed us to have some good decisions. And we, you know, when you look at the fund, the general fund, and the budget reserve account, there would not be a budget reserve account without the work we done in 98-99 on the federal mineral royalties and the cap and directing that money to the general fund and some of those things. Your budget book is another example of what came out of that. So this is very appropriate. The timing is right. I think we need to do it. And you can always learn from the past, and there's a lot of things we gleaned from that discussion we had back then. And I think this is a good time to move forward, and I would ask you to support this.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, what I would like you to do is take a look at page 5 and 6, and these are sort of the areas that we believe are tasks that ought to be assigned out. And that's where this is the opportunity where if you see things that are missing, propose things to add into the list. This is a good checklist for what we'd like management council to look at. One of the things that I believe that is missing that we should consider is an examination and a review of our pension program. Now, with respect to the pension program, that's not technically a state liability. Nevertheless, there is at least a moral obligation to make sure that that fund is secure. And certainly, if it were to go bankrupt, it would cause a significant hardship and a fiscal impact on the state. But with respect to the pension program, we ought to be looking at its level of funding. Is it actuarially sound? Have the steps that we have taken in the last few years, are they sufficient to bring it back to salt to 100% funding level? Things like that. So please look at those paragraphs and think about those. And if you have suggestions of things that you think that are missing that ought to be considered, please add them to the list.
Are you ready for the question?
Nope.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I was here and participated in the previous effort, and I remember a lot of time and effort spent reviewing programs and almost no results. It was largely an exercise in futility, and I wonder what is there here that's going to make this one different.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I think that that's a is wise advice, and when I presented the 2020 vision, it was not my belief that anything new would happen. And but I do believe this. I believe that having oversight committees, and that's one thing that I do envision different, because I don't envision that we're going to create groups to go in and start breaking apart agencies. But having, I think that we ought to set a task list for oversight groups to look at their agencies and maybe at least go through the budget, give an idea of are there programs that are now antiquated? Are there things that ought to be changed? Are there things that could be done differently? In the Department of Health, for example, I think part of the challenge is maybe it's time right now to say, let's figure out whether or not we can rebuild the institutions that our health institutions and lower the cost by investing in capital and infrastructure. And then let's make the decision to get it done now and quickly. Could we reduce our cost? Can we do these things more efficiently? But I think what you part of the exercise, frankly, is when folks go out and they come back and they say there's no place to cut, that is an exercise in itself. I'm not suggesting that we do the same level of activity. But I think that if you are there and you were part of that examination process, when both groups came back, that is the revenues says, hey, there's no place to raise revenues. Expenditure side came back, so there's no way to cut expenditures. That's a realization that if you take that information and then you project that on your future revenues, and you can see that if we continue to do what we're doing, we're going to be broke or have fiscal constraints that are going to require cuts or tax raises, that at least you have that discussion. And but I think about that a lot. This can be a lot of work, it can be a little work, but it's part how much commitment we're going to be put into it. One difference between now and then in the mid-90s. In the mid-90s, we were actually in that environment where we had depleted the rainy day account. We had depleted it. And if we go on a plateau of so many years, if you deplete it in 1 year, then you'll be right back where we were there that year, and it'll be painful. And I do believe that if all we come away from is a policy that judiciously uses the rainy day account, that in itself is a sufficient policy to warrant this activity. But I understand exactly what is said. I don't want to overtax us doing things that are useless, but I do think we ought to find a way to conduct this exercise in a time-sensitive manner and yet come up with some ideas of how to avoid what looks to me like the inevitable. Folks, you know, I've been running the budget, or I was running the budget, for a better part of 10 years. And every year I came down, I had a vision of where the budget was going to go and what was likely to do. And in every one of those years, I was looking for new areas of revenue, things that we could use to develop community colleges, UW, highways. Honestly, this is really the first 2 years, this year and I think next year will be the same when I come down, and that vision that I have is of a plateau out there. And I think it's important for us to invest in our community now, because as we begin to see private layoffs, state projects are going to be important to keep our economic engine in this state moving. But I worry what's out 2 years and 3 years if the oil and gas industry just does not jump back into a high production. But given the amount of gas that is available in the U.S. market and the new finds that are taking place, I still look at a vision that it shows a plateau revenue of 8 to 10 years. And it's important to accept that reality if it's there. If the economists come in and say, hey, no, you're missing something, great. We don't have to worry about it. But if the economists come back and said, you know, your future looks flat, and if there are going to be increases, it's not going to be at the rate of inflation, then it's even more important that the sooner you accept that reality, then the better off you are. And that reality is partly a self-examination of your expenditures and what you can do. And if you come back and said, hey, we're spending all our money wisely, there's no place we can cut, that's an important exercise.
Thank you, Mr. President.
We got a lot of lovely girls up here from Northwest Community College. They're the freshman class, and we'd like to have them stand up and welcome here at the Senate.
Hey!
Senator Landon.
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Since we've interrupted the conversation on this bill, may I have privilege of the floor?
Senator Landon, you may.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you take a look to your right, fellow senators, we have an outstanding group of student and faculty nurses from Casper College, nationally recognized program, might be the best student nurses in the state of Wyoming, right up there. Would you please welcome them to this? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to respond a little bit to my colleague from Natrona County about revenue and expenditures we did in the late 90s, and certainly there were a lot of good that came out of that. The problem was the recommendations that came out in terms of what programs we might want to cut, things we might want to do in terms of the expenditure side. The legislature, quite frankly, didn't have the appetite to do it, but that group put together the opportunities to do it. We also looked at ways to enhance our revenues. We looked at the net result of Tax 2000 was, guess what, an income tax. The legislature wasn't interested in doing an income tax then, and I doubt that it would be today. I certainly would not be. So I think the framework is there to allow us to have those opportunities to make those decisions. The next point will be what we do with that information. The information is important. We need to gather it. We need to have those opportunities presented us. The difference between what we see now, I think, and then, and the President really spoke to that very well, is that back then we saw when it turned around, we would see more of a spike and a larger increase. And then we did that. Now we're going to see the fact that we won't get to those levels. So we got to plan more on a kind of a revenue stream that will not see the spikes be more long and probably a lot less than we want to do with. The other thing we talked about was earmarking. The big part of that is we looked at all those funds and where all the money went, and we looked at de-earmarking, put it back into the general fund so we could get a better handle on our revenues and the way we did them for their expenditures. So it was a good exercise. I think we can get a lot of good out of this. I hope you would support it.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for this bill. This is important, fellow senators. The challenges that we face as a citizens' legislature is the institutional memory and the workload that's put on each of us. And I think a study like this, the exercise alone, would be a benefit. But the report is what I'm kind of looking forward to in the short amount of time that each of us have to do this job in our everyday lives and the jobs and occupations that we have. That report would be very valuable in my case and reading over that. And trying to get us all on the same page as far as these coffee cans or these reserve accounts, our expenditures, our revenue sources, it would, I think, benefit each of us. The challenge that we have in this legislature is not only the turnover, but the institutional memory that we retain. And so I think the concept is good. The exercise would be healthy, and I think the benefits are well, maybe. One of the challenges being chairman of revenue, Mr. Chairman, is, for example, this session, we spent all interim talking about mineral taxes, severance, and ad valorem. Took a whole interim doing that. Come to this session, I got three new members on the revenue committee that haven't had that opportunity to look into those. So we're trying to catch those members up to speed. But think of the time wasted, the time lost, the memory, all those things. And so I can't speak enough about the benefit of this particular bill and this effort, Mr. Chairman. I'll certainly support the bill.
You're ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Peterson's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 122, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Aye. Senate File 122 is passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 116.
Senate File 116, Legislature Compensation.
Point of order.
He's not here, so I figured that, but they gave it to me.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, that was pulled off the board.
The senator that has that bill is out today, and we'll try to get to it tomorrow. So we're on 67.
Senate File 67, Waiver Stabilization Trust Account, sponsored by Senator Escobel. It was referred to Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Kraft, Landon, and Peterson. No, Senators Driscoll and Scott. Senator Scott, Chairman. It was re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. Reports back with a recommendation that it do pass failed in accordance with Senate Rule 5-4. Aye, Senator Hastert. No, Senators Perkins, Ross, and Wassenberger. Excuse, Senator Burns. Senator Ross, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure, Senator Scott?
Mr. Chairman, may the whole rise and report it do so. The recommendation that Senate File 67 do pass. There was a standing committee amendment. I ask it be read at this time.
Senate File 67, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 5.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I move adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. Mr. Chairman, to explain the Standing Committee Amendment, as the bill came to us, this bill had a continuous appropriation in it. It had a very large appropriation for a trust account, and frankly, the committee felt that the appropriation in this magnitude was not realistic, and I would speculate, Mr. Chairman, that the bill was actually written before we had the price and oil collapse and when our revenues looked a lot better than they do now. So what the Standing Committee Amendment does is entirely remove the appropriation and the continuous appropriation.
Question on the amendment.
Yep.
Yes.
And read and moved.
Question.
Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 67, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Amendments passed. We're back on the bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I yield to the sponsor of the bill, Senator Escobel, for an explanation of the Senate file.
Senator Escobel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, you know, I guess in a way, Senate File 67, Waiver Stabilization Trust Account, could very easily have been titled Vision 2020. The bill that we just talked about, we were talking about planning for the future. This stabilization account is planning for the future. It's a simple bill. It basically calls for the establishment of a trust account to provide for the Medicaid waiver program, to provide for those individuals that for whatever reason have not been as gifted and as blessed as other individuals have been. For example, and you all have some material that was passed out with some of the facts of the disability program and acquired brain injuries and things of that nature, but to try to emphasize the point, you know, we often spend part of the morning in the break room reading the sports page, and we admire our athletes. I might say we even worship our athletes. We provide a certain amount of money for them, provide facilities for them, and that's great. But there are some individuals that will never be shown on the sports page, except maybe for some charity event like the Buddy Walk that's held in Laramie on homecoming, I believe, things of that nature. But there's a lot of individuals that will never be on the sports page because of their disabilities. There's individuals that as they grow up, 15, 20, 25 years of age, will never be able to go to the restroom alone. Will never be able to be independent. And many of them will end up in institutions. Now, the question was asked, where did these people come from? Well, they've been with us for a long time, but for the most part, they were kept in the back room, in the basement, things of that nature. It was kind of like some years back, people would ask the neighbors, I haven't seen Sally around lately. Where's she at? Well, she's visiting Grandpa. Well, the truth of the matter was that she had gotten pregnant, and she was sent off to be with relatives. With many of these individuals, they were kept in institutions, been kept hidden from the public. And it is difficult because many of these individuals require a lot of assistance, whether it's wheelchairs, lifts, feeding tubes, personal assistance, things of that nature. You know, so many times when I look at the sports page, I think of all the parents that have children that that when the child was born, they were thinking, one of these days my kid is going to be there on the football team. But the reality is that the child will never be able to be on a football, not be able to be on a football team. But to give you some ideas to what the situation is at this point, and this is a report from the Department of Health, a recent report, and there might be a copy in some of the material that you got, but basically it says that right now we have 143 adults, 251 children, and 82 with acquired brain injuries on the waiting list. And some have been on the waiting list since April 30th, 2012, to the present. You know, for these individuals, it's been raining for quite a while. And to the extent that we can provide some assistance to them, you know, I think this is one of our utmost obligations. These are individuals that, for the most part, are very independent on someone else. And, you know, to the extent that we can provide some comfort, some respite for the parents, I'd certainly like to move in that direction. And some parents, of course, some of these organizations are becoming more vocal. It's easier to communicate. There's more individuals with disabilities, and part of that is because of our medical system. many of the individuals that would have been dead 15, 20 years ago because of medical science have been able to survive, which is a good thing. But, you know, I think we owe it to them to at least provide a life with some sort of dignity. And that's what this bill calls for. It's a way of providing for that, planning for the future. And there was a recent article that just came out that you might have noticed. It says, improving Medicaid for medically complex kids. In the United States, we have 2 million kids served by Medicaid who are considered medically complex because they have a variety of life-threatening conditions that require intensive care by a wide array of specialists. And getting these individuals to different appointments and things of that nature, it's a very stressful situation. And, of course, many of the individuals, providers and advocates, like I said, it's easier to communicate. They see what's in the paper, that there's, you know, how should $2 billion be used? Talks about $95 million for the wildlife fund. At least that's what we're looking for. We do have trust funds available at this point. So having a trust fund for the Medicaid waiver program is not a new concept. So to that extent, that's what that bill is about, creating a Medicaid waiver trust account. And hopefully if we can't fund it at least partially this time, maybe we can do something planning for the future, because there's going to be more of them. And, we're facing a real crisis, in my opinion. From what I understand, some of the providers are facing some very financially difficult times. And where do these individuals go? I don't know. The question was raised about our institutions. And I don't know if we want to go there again, but certainly there might be some that might be appropriate. But for the most part, to the extent that they can stay in the community, be serviced by the community, assisted by the community, I think that's what we all want. But, yeah, it is expensive. And to that extent, this is just one step in moving towards looking at that issue. With that, try to answer any questions you might have, but that's basically what the bill is about.
Senator Bebout.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate our colleague from Laramie County for bringing this to our attention. And I would speak against this bill, Mr. Chairman, for a lot of reasons. First of all, given the nature of our state's revenue stream, this is not the time to start talking about a new trust account. And why would we have a bill to set up a mechanism? We don't have any funds really to put in it. And the other thing, quite frankly, Mr. Chairman, is the state of Wyoming has been, I think, very generous in the way we deal with these people, as we should. They're very important. And, you know, the Department of Health is a substantial part of our budget. We continue to fund that at high levels. That's the way we should do it. We're elected to set priorities. We come down here, we do those priorities. And certainly these individuals, and this is a priority, it's a priority of mine, to set up a trust account to try to get started to have predictable funding is just not the way to do it. I would ask the body to defeat this.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, we have a very real problem in this area. We have been increasing our funding in this area ever since I can remember. And it keeps on growing and growing. And why is that, Mr. Chairman? Mr. Chairman, it's because there's more real need in this area. What goes on here, and I understand, we're talking about developmental disabilities, and there's a wide range from very minor things that people can just take care of to very, very, very severe cases that cost over $300,000 a year to take care of the individual in any kind of civilized way. And you get everything in between, Mr. Chairman. and for the moderately severe and the very severe cases, we get beyond the means of the ordinary family. They simply cannot afford to take care of these children. And so the responsibility falls on the state. And the mechanism we've chosen to use is the Medicaid program, state-federal program, 50-50 split with the feds. And unlike some other parts of Medicaid, fundamentally the feds in this area let the state be sensible as to how to do it. And we've made some efforts. The program got a bit out of control. We've made some efforts, great political cost, to rein the program in. They have been at least partially successful. We've cured one of the major costs, bureaucratic costs, of the bureaucratic sources of the increase in costs. We weren't able to retrieve all the things that were made, and I could go into the waivers in some details to how that happened. But we're on course to be economical there. But still, the demand in this area is going to grow and grow and grow. And the reason, frankly, is the progress of medical science. Like it or not, in our species, a certain, fortunately very small percentage, but a percentage of the births produce individuals that have either genetic problems or as a result of something going wrong in the pregnancy and the birth process wind up with a terrible disability. And we've done as much as we can to prevent that. Some of the prenatal care efforts and whatnot have been able to prevent some of the identifiable causes. Some of the early infant testing has prevented some of the other causing where you have rare metabolic defects in particular that can be cured if caught quickly enough. We've done quite a bit there. But still, the numbers continue to grow. And, Mr. Chairman, I can remember when I was growing up in the 1950s, and my dad was a pediatrician in practice in Casper, I can remember him saying that the basic rule of thumb then was that if a baby was born that weighed less than about 3 pounds, he would have to tell the parents, "You don't have a baby. There's nothing we can do to save it." And those babies, because of their premature birth, were much more likely to have these developmental disabilities. That started to change in the 1960s, and now it's no longer true. You get some very low birth weight babies with severe cases of disabilities, and medical science saves them. And a percentage of them grow up to be perfectly normal adults. You meet them on the street, you have no idea that 60 years earlier that individual would not have survived the first few days of life. Now they do, and they're perfectly normal citizens. But a significant percentage of those have these big disabilities. And we wind up paying for it. And this is an area of our budget that, like it or not, is going to grow and grow and grow. And, you know, the alternatives, frankly, some of them are just unthinkable. And others, like aborting a number of these babies early, are areas, things we do not want to do and we do not want to incentivize. So we have an obligation here. And the trust fund approach in this bill is one approach to that obligation. It's not realistic to fund it this year. If we'd, you know, hindsight is always 20/20. If we'd brought it 6 years ago, maybe we could have funded it. Maybe we wouldn't have because we'd wanted to spend the money on something else. But that's one approach. We authorize it, and then we get back. You know, the price of oil goes back to the ceiling. Price of gas goes to the ceiling. We have another boom. Maybe this is something that ought to be authorized and on the agenda. That's the argument for the bill. But maybe we ought to take care of it, as was suggested, through ongoing appropriations, and we have been generous in this area, appropriately so. Our waiting list is back under some kind of reasonable control, because we appropriated quite a bit of money last year and because we did some reforms. So I will say to the Senate, you've got a choice. You can pick this motion, this method, hope that we'll be able to fund it in some future years, or you will see increasing appropriations, even in bad years. This is one of the reasons you can't live with a total plateau of revenue, why we might have to dip into reserves, even if our revenues stabilize. Because this area will grow, and we'll have to fund it through general fund appropriations, which with the federal program will be matched 50-50. So that's your choice. I voted no in committee because my judgment was that we weren't going to be able to fund this statutory trust account in any reasonable time, and that doing so, you know, it's possible that the various mechanisms we have for funding will change either at the state or the federal level, and some of this won't be appropriate. But if you don't fund things this way, you're going to have to, through increasing general fund appropriations to the Medicaid program, because there just isn't any alternative to spending more money in this area, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kraft.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to piggyback a little bit on the comments made by the good chairman of Labor Health. The reason we're bringing this at this point in time, and the reason it was stripped of all of its funding, is we know very well there is no possible way we can fund anything this year. We get that. We know that. I would present to you that some of our other trust funds that have been created were created first, and it was several years before any funding was put in them. But they were created, so they were available when and if funding becomes available, when and if a private donor comes along. And I would really like to underscore what the good chairman said, that this is a growing problem. A number of our facilities that provide services for these individuals are on the brink of financial disaster. Some of them have already closed. Some of them are teetering. I did ask for that particular organization to give me some cold, hard information as to the financial statistics of these particular facilities. I don't have it yet. If you will allow this bill to proceed to second reading, I will indeed have that information for you then. But I will tell you, it's a problem where we have a population that is growing and our facilities are not able to accommodate them. We have a population whose parents are aging. We heard testimony of 60 and 70-year-old parents trying to take care of 50-year-old seriously disabled individuals. So we're very concerned that this problem is going to do nothing but grow. And who is going to take care of them? Now, we know money is not – we can't do it this year. We know. But why can't we create the trust so that it's there like we've done previously with others, and then have at least that as an option. Because that's what we're looking at. We're trying to be creative. We're trying to come up with options so that each time we say, oh my goodness, we're out of money and we have to come back and beg for more money. That's not the way to do it. We're trying to come up with solutions. Maybe this isn't the right one. I believe it is. I believe that it's at least an option. And I believe it's one for us to consider. Take the money component out. It's not going to happen this year. It can't. But at least allow us to bookmark. At least allow us to create a trust so that we can, in future years, look at ways of providing services for this most vulnerable of our populations. Thank you.
Senator Landon.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I can't match the eloquence of the previous three speakers. I fully understand where our majority floor leader is coming from, and greatly appreciate how educating our chairman of Labor and Health can be. Appreciate my friend from Rock Springs. I wanted to stand up, fellow senators, just to express and help maybe you understand why I was an aye vote in the committee. Even though I fully understand that we don't have the funding this year, we may not have the funding for some years to come, this is one thing right here that we're going to pass off to whoever's going to be sitting here 10, 20 years from now. This is an ongoing expenditure that isn't going to go away. We're going to be funding this thing, and as the chairman says, probably at higher and higher levels, and it's going to come out of our general fund. And I just thought to myself before we voted in committee on this bill, wouldn't it be great if there was some way that we could hand off a funding mechanism that would at least cut into what we have to spend year in and year out for this population. Now, when it went down to the other committee, I regret that none of us from Labor and Health could be there. And so the conversation escalated up to the point of what it would take to completely fund it with dividends and revenue off of that particular trust, and it got into the billions of dollars. We fully understand that's not where we were targeting. We were simply saying that anything we do with this trust account is going to generate some dividends that we can use to help a population that we know is going to be there. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Emmerich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I signed on to this with the good senator from Laramie County, knowing full well that there was not going to be a funding source. But I think the vehicle needs to be put in place, possibly for private fundraising, things of that sort, and the ability for us to fund it many, many years now down the road. But I think I don't want to get into the habit of everything's been said, but not everyone has said it. But I think move this one forward. I think it's the right thing to do.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, on and against the bill. Folks, it is a little disturbing when you see a bill that incorporates concepts that are frankly meaningless. When you see, for example, creating a statutory inviolate corpus, there's no such thing as a statutorily inviolate corpus. If you want inviolate corpus, the only way to do that is by constitution. But the real issue that you have to begin to think about is an underlying policy of how the state of Wyoming funds projects. Now, there was a time, and in fact, there has been a lot of discussion, that wouldn't it be nice to have every element of government funded by a trust fund? So you'd have one trust fund that pays all the state employees. You'd have one trust fund that pays for all of the Department of Health. You'd have another trust fund that pays for all of the judiciary, et cetera, et cetera. The practicality of doing that is nearly impossible. The likelihood that you're going to receive any private funding that goes into a governmental trust is virtually zero. The way we fund government is that we take a look at our revenues and we have to evaluate and allocate among all programs. Even if this had $300 million in it, the amount of revenue it would produce would not delete or remove the obligation of the state to fund it. Moreover, funding becomes more difficult because, in effect, what this is doing is saying, if, in fact, there are surpluses and you had them, give them to my agency, give them to my priority so that I can get a piece of revenue without having to compete with all other interests of the state. If you had $300 million and you believed that it ought to go into a trust fund and you had that capacity, then you put it in the permanent Wyoming Mineral Trust Fund. And when the revenue comes off of it in the form of investment income, then you look at all your priorities and you assign everybody's priorities together. When you begin to look at these statutory trusts, they in fact are earmarked revenues for expenditure. And the expenditures are not well reviewed, but I would give you some examples where not to compare it to and one to compare it to. If you look at the Wildlife Trust Fund, that's one example where we create a statutory trust fund. The objective was to have $200 million in that corpus and that all of the needs of all of those operations would then be self-funded. Of course, we've never reached there. And I submit to you that when you get there, that will still not be a self-funded agency or entity. But at least with respect to the Wildlife Trust Fund, what we did say is bring that money back, we'll appropriate it, and we'll identify it. We didn't use the word continuous appropriations or special earmarks or anything like that. Now let me shift one to the Tobacco Trust Fund. Those are funds that came from the federal government, from settlement. How many people know what the corpus of that is? I know some people know what it is. Maybe one or two people know what that, three people know what the corpus is. How many know what the income off of that trust fund is doing? What funds those tobacco trust fund are going to? Do you even know who gets it first? What if you find out, for example, that the income is going to advertising on billboards instead of going to stop cessation, or maybe that is cessation. But if you had no money, wouldn't you want to take that revenue and say, maybe that revenue ought to go first to treat people with cancer, or maybe it should go first to disabled people, or whatever it is. But you have a substantial corpus out there that not a person here knows anything about. That's not true. That many people don't know what's here, what's in that fund. And there are folks that have gotten into those revenue streams off of there, and they're just sitting out there happily spending their money because it's never reviewed. Their programs are never analyzed. Their income streams are never challenged. And nobody's able to go in and say, you know what? It may have been that 5 years ago your revenue stream or giving you that revenue stream was more important than my program. But today, my program is more necessary than that. You don't even get to do that because they've got this earmarked, dedicated revenue stream. If we had the resources to create trust funds for every program out there and decide in advance what are the most important funds, and we knew that would be static, fair enough, do it. But if you don't have that, which we don't, I submit to you that the prudent thing to do is when you have surpluses, you put it in a permanent mineral trust fund, the money goes into the general fund, and then we determine every year, every biennium, how to allocate those resources fairly based upon the needs of that time.
Senator Kraft.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman. And thanks for that information. I would like to point out that one of the things we did do in the standing committee was delete, on page 1, line 5, we deleted line 5, which says providing an appropriation and a continuous appropriation. On page 4, lines 2 through 4, where it also references a continuous appropriation, that has also been deleted. So we no longer have the language for a continuous appropriation. We would certainly be willing to look at another amendment in addressing the inviolate corpus, but I just present to you once again that this is one option for a problem that is going to do nothing but grow. I just wanted to bring that to the attention of the body. Thank you.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, just one correction. The Tobacco Trust Fund, the federal government had absolutely nothing to do with. That's proceeds off the, with the settlement with the tobacco companies when this state joined most of the other states in the union in a lawsuit against the tobacco companies for the way they promoted cigarette smoking. And it's proceeds from that. I would point out, Mr. Chairman, that it getting that cost an extra third in attorney contingency fees that we would not have had to incur if we'd done the same thing by taxing tobacco more and raised the same amount of money that way. But that is revenue that is dedicated as a result of that lawsuit and the settlement in that. And we're one of the few states that actually retained the corpus largely and has not spent it on all kinds of diverse things. We have spent it on, I know, some substance abuse work. We spend it on tobacco cessation programs. There are a number of things, but it does get appropriated for some of those purposes.
Senator Barnard.
Mr. Chairman, I think we're having a good discussion here. I'd just like to corroborate what Senator Kraft told you. I've been getting calls from some of the DD waiver providers in my area, and the one DD program provider in Evanston is losing $85,000 a month. There's another DD program in the middle of the state that's losing the same one. There's a DD program here in Cheyenne that has always been profitable, and it's now losing money. There's a DD program in Torrington that has already filed for Chapter 11 and is pretty much out of business. So what my main message and my main plea here is go home and talk to your DD waiver people and ask them what condition are you in? What does your future look like? And I would like you to come back and prove me wrong and everybody say, hey, everybody's really doing well. But I think you're going to find out that a lot of these providers are in big trouble. So you have a choice, just like the good senator from Natrona County said. You can pony up and spend the money on them, or you can wait until their suits, these people cause more problems in the long run. They require a certain amount of money per year. Some of them require a lot of money. Some require very little money. But right now, with the way the DV program is running, when we did our legislation that told the Department of Health to cut the DD waivers, they did exactly what we told them to. They cut the money. They took 500 people, put them on the waivers, and never increased the amount of money that was being given. That means those people are getting 50% roughly less than what they got before. So you have a problem, it's brewing, it's going to come to fruition one of these days, and I just would like you to know that.
Senator Bevout.
Yeah, and thank you, Mr. Chairman. Very quickly, I think we've lost what this bill is all about. And what we're talking about in terms of the funding and the issues faced with those DD waiver institutions, I totally agree. But a trust fund, in my opinion, you still have to appropriate the money. You haven't got to the real issue. If we really think that that's a high priority, and I quite frankly agree, we step up and we have. If you recall during the last budget session, I think we put in $10 million of state funds, $10 million of federal funds to deal with the DD waiver list. We did that without a trust fund. We're talking about two separate things here. And if you talk about how you prioritize, just think if, as the president made the point of all trust funds everywhere, you tried to go get money to help the DD waiver, but all the other trust funds and all the money was taken up, you wouldn't even have any money to do what you want to take care of in the first place. So let's deal with that in a separate way. Let's talk about this as a trust fund. Quite frankly, I think it's a bad idea and we should kill it.
Members of the body, let's direct our comments to the bill. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Totally agree with those comments that were, have been made by our majority floor leader and our good president. Having served on appropriations for about 6 years, I get it. And I've seen the expenses grow phenomenally. I mean, we're talking pretty serious money and how that affects the rest of our budget. I guess my question is, you know, the spirit that this bill came to us in was a creative approach to try to somehow get ahead of the game. You know, the words of the cost might increase. Let's drop that word might. The costs will increase. We have seen that. And I can guarantee that they will continue to grow. The numbers will continue to grow. Our good majority floor leader stated a fact. We have been very generous as a state to try to take care of the waiting list and appropriate more money. As the Department of Health proved to us that the numbers were there and the needs were there, and we stepped up and we've appropriated those funds. But the problem is it continues to grow. And I don't know. Our good president used the word phenomenal. What's to explain this phenomena and in this program? And, of course, we've mentioned, too, today, the cost drivers are costs going up, more expensive, and the numbers. And the reason is because of the medical advancements that we've made, and those points have been made by our good chairman of Labor and Health. But the spirit that this came to us in was trying to create a creative solution. These came from the providers, parents, the users of these monies for their sons and daughters. And they don't feel good about coming and saying, we're broke. We don't have any more money. We need more money. And we turn as an appropriations committee and say, okay, well, let's take it from here, take it from here. Maybe library's gone. Maybe, you know, let's eliminate some of the fluff. And so it was a creative approach. I see no harm, no foul here. The appropriation's been deleted. Create the trust fund. Think of our wildlife trust fund and what that's done for our wildlife in this state. We continue to appropriate money when that window of opportunity is there and when we have the money. When we don't appropriate. Pretty simple. And I agree, it's going to take a large amount of money in this trust fund eventually to create the revenues that we would like to see. But right now, creating a trust fund with no appropriation, no harm, no foul, Mr. Chairman.
Sponsor, Senator Esquivel, would you like to have the last word on this?
Hope I don't misquote you, my good friend from Lander. Basically, what he said was, we don't have a fund that targets where the service is needed most. It needs support to assist those with an outdated service model. You know, so what we're looking for is to create a fund that targets where the service is needed most. In addition, I might add that I have faith in some of our private donors. You know, Wyoming is number one with the highest number of billionaires per capita. Number one. Who knows? One of them might feel a little bit generous. Maybe feel a little bit guilty. I don't know. But I have faith that some of those donations might come in. They do to the university. So anyway, thank you.
You ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion, when the Committee of the Whole rise and report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 67, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The chair is in doubt. All those in favor stand. Those opposed? Chair votes no. Having failed, pursuant to, point of order, Mr. Majority Floor Leader, the vote was 13 to 14. 13-14. 14 no's. Senate File 67 has failed. The standing division of the roll call required. Will the Chief Clerk call the roll?
Anderson District 2?
No.
Anderson District 28?
Yes.
Oh. Barnard?
Aye.
Bebout?
No.
Burns excused case?
Aye.
Christensen?
No.
Coe?
No.
Cooper?
No.
Kraft?
Aye.
Dockstetter?
No.
Driscoll excused Emmerich?
Aye.
Escobel?
Aye.
Geis?
No.
Hastert?
Aye.
Hicks?
No.
Johnson excused Kinski?
No.
Landon?
Aye.
Meyer?
Aye.
Pappas?
Aye.
Perkins?
No.
Peterson?
Aye.
Ross?
Aye.
Rothfuss?
Aye.
Scott?
No.
Von Fladern?
No.
Wasserberger? President Nicholas. Closing vote. Closing vote closed. 13 aye, 14 no, 3 excused.
Senate File 67, having failed, roll call vote pursuant to SR 11-5A is deemed indefinitely postponed. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 104.
Senate File 104, Campaign Reports Unopposed Candidates, sponsored by Senator Meyer. It was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporation Election Political Subdivision, who reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Hicks, Meyer, and Scott. No, Senator Case and Pappas. Senator Case, Chairman.
Having read the reading of the bill, what's your pleasure, Senator Case?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report to do so, that we pass recommendation on Senate File 104. There is a standing committee amendment, and I'd ask to be read in at this time.
Senate File 104, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 7.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, this I'm going to talk about the amendment first because that considerably shortens the bill, Mr. Chairman. If you go to page 2, lines 8 through 23, section Romanet 2 and 3 are deleted as well as what's on the top of page 3. What that does, Mr. Chairman, is that it leaves in the bill the language in Romanet 1, which is every candidate, except a candidate that is running unopposed, shall file a fully itemized statement of receipts at least 7 days before any primary, general, or special election with information required by this subsection. To any day from the 8th day up to the 14th day before the election. So it takes this bill then takes away some of the reporting requirements if you're unopposed. I think one of the biggest reasons we did that was because of the fiscal note. If we changed it to the 31st, there's a substantial programming requirement within the Secretary of State's office. There'll be a small fiscal note probably that they'll be getting back to us to see whether or not they can do that, but it's going to be relatively small in comparison. The discussion basically was that roughly a third or more of the candidates that ran for the legislature ran unopposed this time. almost that many didn't file some of their reports. So essentially, if you don't have a whole heck of a lot to file, you can wait till after the elections and you catch up with your expenditures and receipts after 10 days after the primary or the general. So I stand for any questions.
Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
We need to move that.
Yeah, I don't think we dispose of it. Well,
right.
How about if I yield back and we dispose of the amendment?
Yeah. Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I apologize. I think the amendment has been read in, hasn't it?
Correct. Okay,
then I would move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 104, ask for the body's favorable consideration.
All those in favor of Senator Case's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 104, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Amendment passes. We're back on the bill. Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was a no vote in committee. Mr. Chairman, there's a couple of things. I think this bill got a little... The discussion in this bill seems to be about folks that don't like the electronic reporting system, frankly, and they find that burdensome. And sometimes their telephone system doesn't work where they are, and their internet doesn't work, and the requirements of filing these reports electronically is something they don't like. But that's not what this bill is about. This is about whether or not you have to file the reports. They do have to be electronic, but you could take, you know, this is not about a bill about getting rid of the electronic filing. This is about whether an unopposed candidate should file reports like everyone else. The testimony in committee, I think, by public interest was that this is important information to know, that where you receive your money is very important. And that it's important to get it before the election. There was also some discussion in committee about the fact that you may not even know whether you're unopposed or not. As write-in campaigns, you know, and things like that percolate out there. Finally, I'd be remiss, and I'm not sure that I agree with this, but the Secretary of State's office is holding fast to their impression that this would cost $175,000 to implement. Now, I don't really buy that because I can believe, and I haven't had a discussion with the Secretary of State because we've just missed connections with all the meetings and things, but I believe that this bill could be implemented without any fiscal requirement because they could exactly do what they do now. They could even report that the unopposed candidate didn't file the report.
But there could, our law could say that they're not required to do so, and, you know, that's the end of it. You match up the fact. I just don't see the $175,000, but I need to represent to you that they're very much sticking to their guns on that, and they say that it does require that, and they're going to provide more explanation when I get in touch with them. But that all being said, I'm opposed to the bill on principle grounds. I think that everybody ought to file, whether you're unopposed or not, and that's good public policy.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm against the bill for similar reasons, but looking at the analysis, just because you're not opposed, it certainly doesn't mean that you don't receive contributions. And it also doesn't mean that you can't give contributions from your campaign account to influence other elections. So there's an awful lot of things that can happen as an unopposed candidate that are critical information to the voting public that really do have an influence on a good democratic process, on transparency. So the simple fact that you're unopposed at a certain time should not preclude you, in my view, Mr. Chairman, from having to make these reports. That would be the first point. The second is, realistically, these are not onerous reporting requirements. In fact, although I have at times also ended up struggling to remember to make the timeline, I've gotten calls from folks that have said it's time to file. I log in, I do the filing. There are a couple of potential snafus that might need to be ironed out, but this is hardly an onerous burden to file that simple online report, particularly if you try a few days early, and if you have any problems, you have an easy time contacting the Secretary of State's office. So, Mr. Chairman, I think we can, even as an unopposed candidate, suffer through the burden that is the reporting requirement, and I think we should continue as we are now, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I was an aye vote in committee. Mr. Chairman, I think the key to this is that you're not getting out of filing the information. The point in the 7-day before the election filing was to have the information on where candidates' money was coming out before decisions were made in the election. Frankly, and then you have to file everything after the election. So it all gets filed within 10 days of the primary and then 10 days after the general, same as everybody else. So all the information gets filed. What this does is get rid of the early filing requirement because it's simply not relevant in an uncontested election. Where you get a successful write-in campaign, that's usually the primary, and then the information is relevant, the general, and would have been automatically reported if this bill passes. The burden, there is a problem, frankly, with the electronic filing system for some of us in the rural area that do not have that reliable an internet connection. And we heard of one instance, the individual had to drive to Cheyenne, I believe, to get the filing made. And that's a problem. But that is, Mr. Chairman, a separate issue. The real burden here is that people, being logical, say, I was unopposed, why should I bother to file this 7 day before the thing? And they don't. And then the Secretary of State's office has to spend a lot of time pursuing them to get the filing made, possibly turning them in the Attorney General, and it's just a lot of unnecessary hassle and burden on all those concerned because the information gets reported in the after-election things. So let's simplify life and get rid of it where it's not really needed because we know that we will get that report within 10 days after the primary and after the general election.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I too was a no vote in committee. Basically, I have issues, as good Senator from Laramie mentioned, about transparency. I don't think we ought to reduce the amount of transparency that's in our system. And frankly, I don't believe that we ought to have a system that has two standards. I think if all candidates should file the same reports, whether you're unopposed or opposed. That way it's clear. There's not two different rules for filing. I just believe it's less burdensome on the Secretary of State's office. I know there will be a fiscal note of some kind, whether it's $175,000 or not. Frankly, if it's only $5,000, I don't think we need that. I believe that the folks that are running as candidates, they filed twice during the primary and twice during the general election. I believe that the time frame that they're giving us to file is plenty of time. I understand the need or the problem with spotty internet connections, but that's an issue when you're living in remote areas. That it's a hurdle on for the candidate to jump over. However, I think it's a hurdle that is not that onerous, and that providing the transparency to people who log on and want to look at the report, and when they don't see a report for a particular person, they're wondering why. So I believe that we ought to just have a standard for all candidates that's the same. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Perkins.
Just a quick question, if they had any discussion on it. And so it says that the premises you run in and opposed, but now we know from a bill that we passed just a little while ago you really classify between successful and unsuccessful candidates, and there's one that if you got a vote, you were an unsuccessful. If you got at least one vote but didn't win the election, you were a unsuccessful candidate. Well, now if you have this, if somebody writes in and they get one vote, there's an unsuccessful candidate in the primary, no longer are you unopposed, and now you're behind the deadline. So, whether you pass this before or not, you better solve that problem because you're de facto in trouble.
Senator Landon.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Just a quick comment. I'll be a no vote on the bill. My deskmate really came to the heart of the issue for me, which is I just really don't need to take a vote home to my constituents saying we're gonna keep some information from you. I just don't find it that onerous, and I think it's important for us to be as transparent as we can be. So I'll be a no vote. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, on the question of a write-in vote or two, that was discussed in the committee, and the advice we had was that in some other circumstances, the election officials, I believe one of the county clerks was the one involved, ruled and it was accepted that it's uncontested if there's no other candidate filed, that a write-in campaign doesn't qualify.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And really, folks, as a candidate, I've got a candidates committee, and I've got a committee to elect Kurt Meyer. And the candidates committee, I've got 000 on my expenditures and 000 on my contributions. And basically what this says is that it doesn't go to that I don't have any income or expenditures, but in that case, it doesn't make any difference whether you're all zeros or not. You're still, if you don't get the thing filed on time, you're still breaking the law, even if it's all zeros. And that's what we're trying to, trying to get away from, is that if you don't have any expenditures and you don't have any money coming in, you're not hiding anything from the public one way or the other, because there's nothing to hide. So you really don't have anything that's not transparent, because it doesn't exist. So, those are things that, that I think that a lot of folks that run unopposed, basically, that the money doesn't come in, you don't ask for money. About the only thing that I know that I did in this year was $154 for a thank you advertisement for people. And that was it. That was after the election. That was after the election. So, and I did get my stuff filed on time this year, so we're all right in the general. So, Mr. Chairman, I would hope that we would consider this. I think it's a bill that's, because of all the different, the amount of unopposed races we have, it is burdensome, especially if the wind blows down in my place, the satellite antenna goes to the side, and that thing might be 3 weeks before I get service. So.
Question on the bill. All those in favor of Senator Case's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 104, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
Having failed, Committee of the Whole. Okay. All those in favor, stand. All those against? Seven to 19, transparency prevails in the Wyoming Senate. Pursuant to Senate Resolution 11-5, having failed a standing division, a roll call vote is required. Will the chief clerk call the roll?
Anderson District 2. Anderson District 28. Barnard?
No.
Bebout?
Aye.
Burns excused. Case?
No.
Christensen?
No.
Coe?
Aye.
Cooper?
Aye.
Kraft?
No.
Dockstetter?
No.
Driscoll excused. Emmerich?
No.
Escobel?
No.
Geis?
No.
Hastert?
No.
Hicks?
Aye.
Johnson excused. Kinski?
No.
Landon? Meyer?
Aye.
Pappas?
No.
Perkins?
No.
Peterson?
Aye.
Ross?
No.
Rothfuss?
No.
Scott?
Aye.
Von Platern?
No.
Wasserberger?
No.
President Nicholas? Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. 8 aye, 19 no, 3 excused.
Senate File 104, having failed a roll call vote, is deemed indefinitely postponed. Mr. Majority Floor Leader. You've heard the reading of the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carried.
Reports from standing committees. Report from standing committees. We're not done yet. We're still working.
February the 5th, 2015, Mr. President, your committee number 2, Appropriations. To whom was referred Senate File 145, Hospital uncompensated care reports back with a recommended do pass amended failed in accordance with Senate Rule 5-4. Ayes Hastert, noes Perkins, Ross, and Wassenberger. Excuse Senator Burns, Senator Ross, Chairman. February the 5th, 2015, Mr. President, your committee number 3, Revenue, to whom was referred Senate File 124, Sales and Use Tax Enforcement, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Case, Driscoll, Kinsey, Landon, and Peterson, Senator Peterson, Chairman. February the 5th, 2015, Mr. President, your committee number 7, Corporation Election Political Subdivisions, to whom was resented Senate File 128, Election Runoffs, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Case, Hicks, Meyer, Pappas, and Scott, Senator Case, Chairman. February the 5th, 2015, Mr. President, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred Senate File 138, Small Business Innovation Research Matching Funds, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Hastert, Perkett, Ross, and Wassenberger, excuse Senator Burns, Senator Ross, Chairman. February the 5th, 2015, Mr. President, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred Senate File 133, Bighorn Sheep Relocation, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass fail in accordance with Senate Rule 5-4. Aye, Senators Perkins and Ross, no, Senators Hastert, and Wassenberger, excuse Senator Burns, Senator Ross, Chairman. February the 5th, 2015, Mr. President, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred Senate File 121, Career and Technical Training Grants, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Hastert, Perkins, Ross, and Wassenberger, excuse Senator Burns, Senator Ross, Chairman. February the 5th, 2015, Mr. President, your committee number 3, Revenue, to whom was referred Senate File 144, Microbreweries Minimum Barrel Requirement, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Case, Driscoll, Kinsey, Landon, and Peterson, Senator Peterson, Chairman. February the 5th, 2015, Mr. President, your committee number 3, Revenue, to whom was referred Senate File 96, Special Investigator, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Kinsey, Landon, and Peterson, no, Senators Case and Driscoll, Senator Peterson, Chairman.
Senator Case.
Mr. President, Senate File 128, I believe it's called Runoff Elections, was just read in. It does have an appropriation coming about through the Standing Committee Amendment. I'd ask that it be re-referred.
Without objection, Senate File 128 is re-referred to Appropriations Committee Number 2. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, we're back at that order of business of bills on general file.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I move that the Senate resolve itself back into the Committee of the Whole to discuss the last two bills on general file.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion was passed by one.
Committee of the Whole will please come to order. The first bill for our consideration is Senate File 138. Will the reading clerk read the bill?
Senate File 138, Small Businesses Innovation Research Matching Fund, sponsored by Senator Rothfuss. It was referred to committee number 9, Minerals Business Economic Development. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Anderson, 28, Cole, Cooper, Rothfuss, Von Flateren, Senator Von Flateren, Chairman. It was re-referred to committee number 2, Appropriations. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Hastert, Perkins, Ross, Wassenberger, excuse, Senator Byrne, Senator Ross, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure, Senator Von Flateren?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move when the committee of the whole rises to report. It does so with a due pass recommendation on Senate File 138. And there is a standing committee amendment. I ask that it be read in.
Senate File 138, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 8, line 22.
And, Mr. Chairman, we could dispense with this is just a cleanup amendment. I do move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 138. This is just a cleanup. Senators, on page 8, line 22, on the bottom of that line, last reference was wrong. It should be 912-201. So strike the 912-301, insert 912-201. And then page 9, line 3, at the end of that line, they had the word education. It's actually the energy, so it's Business Council, Science, Technology, and Energy Authority. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd ask for the question.
All those in favor of Senator Von Flateren's motion to adopt the Standing Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 138, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment passes. We're back on the bill.
And, Mr. Chairman, I yield the floor to Senator Rothfuss.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I bring Senate File 138, Small Business Innovation Research Matching Funds. Mr. Chairman, this is a piece of legislation that's intended to spur innovation, research, and development, and to try to provide for economic development from some of our small businesses around the state. It's modeled after a relatively new program that some other states have tried out that I heard from our director of research at the University of Wyoming. In conjunction with the Wyoming Business Council, we've worked together to put together this legislation to see if we can help to stimulate some of this innovative research. And the intent of this legislation is to provide some matching funds to federal funds that are provided through the Small Business Innovative Research Program. Now, Mr. Chairman, that program is a highly competitive program for research and development that has the potential for commercialization. There are 11 federal agencies that are involved in SBIR research, including Department of Agriculture, Defense, Education, Energy, Health and Human Services, Homeland Security, Transportation, Commerce, NASA, and the National Science Foundation. Mr. Chairman, this is a long-standing federal research program that has had many, many commercializations to its claims, and we've had a lot of SBIR funds in Wyoming over the past couple of decades. There are currently 18 businesses in Wyoming, which started from an idea less than 15 years ago and are now thriving enterprises in a large part due to the success of the commercialization of their SBIR awards. The Wyoming Business Council has tracked the fact that these businesses are responsible for, so far, 140 jobs in Wyoming with an average salary of around $70,000 per year. So we've already had success in Wyoming with SBIR research. The intent here is to try and leverage those dollars and lead to more success. So, Mr. Chairman, what this legislation does, as we go to page 2 of the legislation, is to create a Wyoming Small Business Innovation Research Matching Funds program that's administered through the University of Wyoming Research Office in conjunction with the Wyoming Business Council. To be eligible for any funds, matching funds under this program, you have to be a Wyoming corporation with a meaningful nexus in Wyoming, and you have to be receiving federal Small Business Innovative Research funds, and then work in conjunction with the University of Wyoming Research Office to do so. All of the funding opportunities under the SBIR have a commercialization intent. In other words, they're all supposed to get you, if successful, some type of innovative, commercializable product. That's the objective. Many of the phase ones fail, some of the phase twos fail, But the idea is to try and come up with something that has a positive economic value in the Wyoming marketplace. Mr. Chairman, bottom of page 3 and on to page 4 provides an agreement that if you're going for these matching funds, you'll provide a report of the impact of these funds and of the commercializable project that you're working on, as well as sales and revenues over a 10-year period after that commercialization. Mr. Chairman, on page 4, moving on to page 5, is really the heart of the bill, which talks about the matching fund award program that would go into effect with the passage of SF 138. For a phase 1 award, there would be a potential match up to 100% of the award, not to exceed $100,000. Now, in a phase 1 SBIR grant, it's basically a $100,000 grant most of the time. It can go up to $150,000, but $100,000 is common. And that's typically to try and get you one man year of research along with the supplies and costs associated with doing that research. And it's been that number for quite some time. By matching that, you really elevate the amount of funds that are available to do that quality research. And once again, there's a competitive process already in place through the federal agencies, and it's a very competitive landscape to try and get these SBIR dollars. There are federal audit requirements. There are federal reporting requirements. And with this legislation, we would receive those reports, and we would be able to have access, obviously, to the audited information. So we would have some proof of that integrity. So the phase one would be matched at 100%. Phase two awards, which are a small subset of phase ones. You do a phase one, then you apply for a phase two, and if you have commercialization potential, you can get the phase two award, which is typically up to $1 million. Phase two would only be matched at 25%, up to $250,000, but the intent here is recognizing that one of the shortcomings of the SBIR program is that you receive the phase one funding, and then if you apply to phase two and receive that, are granted it, there's a gap, an unfunded gap prior to receiving the phase two dollars. So that gap would be filled with this match, the availability of these grants to reach the phase two without having to suspend the research or foot it internally. Little D on page 5 talks about a requirement to repay all matching funds awarded under this section. Basically, if you commercialize a product, you're successful, and then you leave the state of Wyoming and don't maintain a nexus in the state, you're responsible for making a full repayment of those funds. Little E discusses the promulgation of rules and regulations for this process between the Wyoming Business Council and the University Department of Research Office, as well as eligibility requirements. That moves on to page 7, a reporting requirement a few years out, and little F on lines 9 and beyond. That reporting requirement is described on the bottom of page 7 and into page 8. On page 8, there's a definition of commercialization, whereby it requires that you receive revenues in excess of 3 times the matching funds awarded under this section. So if you do that, you've reached a point of commercialization in theory, and you would then be responsible for obligations to stay in the state and continue the commercialization without having to repay. 912.1402 is the creation of the Small Business Innovation Research Matching Funds account that's established and provides for the authorization to use those funds for this program. And then Section 2 is the appropriation, but it's a reappropriation, not a new appropriation, Senators and Mr. Chairman. What this indicates is that there is appropriated all unexpended, unobligated, and unencumbered funds from the Wyoming Business Council Science, Technology, and Energy Authority account. When you look at the fiscal note on the back, Mr. Chairman, you see that that account currently has a balance of $536,387, and that the Wyoming Business Council has already indicated that rather than having that money sit in the account, they think this is a perfectly reasonable and useful way to prototype this Small Business Innovative Research Matching Program to try and utilize those funds in a better fashion than sitting there and earning the 2% accrual rate of interest that they currently project they'll get that you can see on the non-administrative impact. Mr. Chairman, that's the legislation. The intent here is to try and stimulate innovative research and development in the state of Wyoming to use existing funds, not a new appropriation, to see if this program works. If it does, they can come back and report on it and let us know if they need more funds. If it doesn't work, they'll come back and report that to us, and we'll know better. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd answer any questions on this legislation.
Senator Bevout.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, just a question for the sponsor, and Steve has been around a long time. And I want to, other than it being on the Wolf's accounting system, which doesn't necessarily reflect that it's available, do we know that that has not, that that's not money that should have gone back into the system and it's not really there and available? That's the first question I have. And then the second question, under the language of STIA, is there any way, shape, or form, if the money is available, that we're violating how that was appropriated in the first place? I just want to be sure we're doing it correct technically.
Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, might as well pile on. Mr. Chairman, my question is regarding constitutionality. How is this not a grant of or loan or aid of a private business and, or other entity like under Section 16.6 of our Constitution?
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question I have, and this goes back in a lot of memories, and maybe the program has changed in 20, 25 years ago, but if I recall, there was something that the federal government, there was a prohibition about marketing or using funds for marketing. And I know that you talk about commercialization here, and what I remember what the old SBIR program was is that you could build a prototype and you could get it all the way to where you could actually sell it, but that's where it stopped. And I didn't know if that was the same way the program is, and this is how you're envisioning this program.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the questions, all of which we certainly considered as we were drafting this legislation, and they're good points. With regard to the STIA program and the availability, there specifically was a concern in the Wolf system with regard to the availability of the funds. That was cleared up, and there was a determination and an agreement that the funds that appear to be available are still available for this program. Whether or not it violates the original standing of the STIA funds, that, too, was looked into specifically by our staff, and there was agreement that there was one pool of funds that were originally appropriated for STIA that would not have been authorized under this, but the following appropriations that this would be drawing upon were, in fact, available, and I can get you those opinions and analysis if needed. With regard to the good senator and the constitutionality of this for a grant, there's a lot of obligations for reporting requirements, for commercialization and product concept, for maintaining economic development in Wyoming that are consistent with other programs we've put forward. And the feeling is that this is consistent with a lot of the other economic development programs that we put forward and is in keeping with those. Now, Mr. Chairman, I know that that won't necessarily satisfy everybody, but we were trying to parallel all of the previous projects that we've determined were relatively constitutional, and I can get some analysis on second reading if need be, or specifically to the senator to help alleviate those concerns, hopefully from staff. I have some additional information there available. And as to the good senator's concerns about the marketing possibility and stopping short, yes, SBIR achieves the pilot scale commercialization aspect. There would be no funds used for any marketing purposes, only developing a technology that is then commercializable. Phase one is a pilot scale, and then from there you're supposed to commercialize it up beyond that. So it's a pre-commercialization but towards a commercialization process. Mr. Chairman, hopefully that answers the questions. I'd be happy to answer any more.
Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I'll be very interested in the further information about constitutionality. I can think of two ways that this could occur constitutionally. One would be under Article 16, Section 12, which is the Economic Development Loan Fund. That's what we originally called the Amendment 4 Loan Fund, if this were legacy money from that, possibly. But that's one way. But additional funds for that require two-thirds vote of the legislature. The other way that some folks might think is possible is Article 16, Section 13, which is the industrial and economic development powers of counties and municipalities, where local governments can use local resources. There's restriction on which resources they can use, but they can certainly use, for example, sales tax proceeds for economic development purposes. That is in our Constitution. That's the most recent thing that the people have passed with regard to using taxpayer-funded money for economic development. And I'd just be interested in some of that analysis. It's a great interest of mine, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rothfuss. Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Von Flattern's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 138, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. Motion passes. Committee of the Whole. Bill passes. Committee of the Whole. Next bill for your consideration. Yep. Senate File 138 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 121.
Senate File 121, Career and Technical Training Grants, sponsored by Senator Hastert. It was referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals Business Economic Development, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Anderson, 28. Cole, Cooper, Rothfuss, Von Flateren, Senator Von Flateren, Chairman. It was re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Hastert, Perkins, Ross, Wassenberger, excuse Senator Burns, Senator Ross, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure, Senator Von Flateren?
Mr. Chairman, I move when the Committee of the Whole rises to report to do so with a do pass recommendation on Senate File 121, and I yield the floor to Senator Hastert to explain.
Senator Hastert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate. Senate File 121, Career and Technical Training Grants. I'm going to just kind of reference it as an old friend that's been around here, and we've had some discussions on this in the past. I bring the Career and Technical Training Grants. It's department that utilizes this kind of activity reports to us that 75% of the jobs in the state of Wyoming will be of the career and technical nature, members of the Senate. And what we're doing here is providing for non-traditional students to get into the career and tech field. So if someone has you know, been through high school and maybe college and decided that they didn't want to, that wasn't working out, that they could possibly get into the career and technical field, and that there would be a mechanism set up that we could help, that there would be a way to help with that career and technical training to help with people in the workforce. Some of the testimony that we had in the committee certainly was, you know, that this is a specific group of that don't have an opportunity for funds otherwise, and you know, trying to look at getting women into non-traditional employment and getting our youth, keeping our youth in the state of Wyoming, Mr. Chairman, and that by means of doing that, the bill has a payback provision that if you're awarded a grant under this legislation, then by rule and regulation, the department would then require some kind of payback as far as amount of time that you would stay in the state of Wyoming to work, and that would be commensurate to the loan that you were given, Mr. Chairman. That's kind of like what we do in some ways with the WAMI program. You know, with the Hathaway, we're not able to do things like that. And so, you know, this is kind of targeting, you know, to a group of people that we've been hearing for the last year that this is really an unmet need in the state of Wyoming. And Mr. Chairman, I can cite my own employer who has been having issues filling some career and technical jobs. There's been we're kind of short electricians, and we have been looking for electricians and mechanics for quite some time. And these are really good-paying jobs, Mr. Chairman, but there's a shortage, and they're having a hard time finding folks to do that. So this is just kind of an incentive to help people to do that. And one of the things that we've done in the past, Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate, is I had came in with this legislation with a sizable appropriation, and I didn't do that this year. I restructured the bill with the idea and keeping in mind the issues with the amount of revenues that we had, and we're tailoring this back to setting up an account and making this a grant and donation program. There is a couple of appropriations in there, one to allow the department to established a program, and one for what I'm going to call seed money into the program, Mr. Chairman. So the structure of the program remains the same, but the way we fund it is just slightly different. We've had businesses and a lot of different groups out there very interested in this. So we were just trying to kind of stay in the spirit of not really spending money on anything new here, that we get this going, we put a little seed money in, and then, Mr. Chairman, kind of walking through the bill, on page 2, we get into definitions. Page 3 is just the purpose of career and technical, and that the department shall, by rule and regulation, establish and administer the program. And line C there, the department is authorized to promulgate rules for the program. On to page 4, talks about what won't be reimbursed, and we stay away from service eligibles to be paid for by another public or private program. Services historically paid by another source. We don't want to supplant any organizations' training programs, Mr. Chairman, as we've done in the past. And then the career and technical training grant account on the bottom of page 4. This is creating the account. And, Mr. Chairman, I noted that when I was looking over the bill and rereading it, I wasn't really clear on where the account was going to be established in. And I talked to staff about that, and they informed me that when we create an account, there's other statutes that reference the fact that it's given, so to speak, that these are being created in the auditor's office. So the account would reside in the auditor's office, Mr. Chairman. Then on page 5, that no money shall be appropriated or not out of the account or grants awarded until the account reached $2 million, and that was just to ensure that there was a sizable amount to work with members of the Senate. And then on the bottom of page 5, it outlines the eligibility. On into page 6, that you have to have graduated from high school. Baseline prerequisites and ability and skills necessary is determined by the department. And then the equivalent of 2 years for a training grant, but then on to that it allows for up to 4 years. And that, you see that language on the top of page, continuing on the top of page 7, that just simply allows for folks getting into military service or religious service have that ability to have that little bit of a gap. And then it continues on, if you're not eligible, if you're not a citizen, if not complied with selective service in default of a loan or a refund under Title IV training and financial aid programs, but that if you got yourself up to snuff with all of those, that you could receive those a grant, and then is incarcerated, not eligible to hold a license, has been a recipient for more than 2 years of the Hathaway. And we were really, this was really structured to stay away from folks that were Hathaway eligible. And this is, like I said, for more of non-traditional. So we wanted to make sure that, you know, someone wasn't dovetailing or going off the Hathaway with this. And then on to page 9, where the department would pay the cost of any kind of eligible applications, readiness testing. That's if they're still doing that. And then I was told from the department that they would be working with the training entity to ensure the individual had the proper credentials to the whatever grant they were awarded. And then on the bottom of page 9, the payments will go directly to the training provider. And then on to page 10, ensuring that working in the trades and working in the state, and then if there's a breach of contract, and that then on the line C is the department will show to provide technical assistance, and then page 10 through 11 is reporting requirements, and then 11 and 12 are the two appropriations for $50,000 each. And as I stated, the first one is there's one for establishing the account, a little seed money, and then the other one is the account is $50,000. And I think I skipped over, Mr. Chairman, and I wanted to touch on the fact that we talk about on the bottom of page 11 the amount of on page 9 on line 19 the amount that what could be awarded. And there was a little bit of discussion about that, and we might have a little talk about that or possibly an amendment. The idea of that language was initially when we were footing the entire bill, and that wouldn't not exceed the amount of a Hathaway career grant. And I think a little bit of rewording might be in order to better facilitate that part of it. But anyway, that's the bill. That's what we're doing. It's just it's the same kind of program. It's for career and technical education. And instead of a major appropriation, we're going to let the account grow through grants and donations. And, Mr. Chairman, I'll stand for questions.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'll be brief. Recently, one of the counties in my district, by means of a 6 cent, has under construction an outreach building for its community college to provide some of the things that are mentioned in this bill. So I'll just quickly call your attention. Line 13, page 3, section B, this is what the bill says. The purpose of the Career Technical Training Grant Program is to provide career and technical training grants to develop or enhance the skills of Wyoming's workforce based on current, projected, or emerging labor shortages in Wyoming, in Wyoming's economy. And I'd simply say that's in direct line with the objectives that we had when we went to the effort of constructing this building, which will open during the summer. Be ready next fall. I'd urge your favorable consideration.
Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I, too, will be brief, but on and for the bill. Appreciate the work that our friend from Sweetwater County has gone through to put the sideboards up and tighten this. And just two things, fellow senators. I've got a relative who is in the electrical business and was visiting with him not long ago, and he said that he was having a heck of a time finding apprentice electricians. In fact, could not find anyone to hire. And these are jobs that he said would start at $60,000 or $70,000 a year. And he simply cannot find workers. That's first. Second, as you know, I represent an agency up in the central part of the state, a college, and we're struggling, folks, to find people to go into these career opportunities in our welding and our diesel power programs. We can't even get them to graduation time before they're being snapped up. That's the demand that's out there, and that's the need that's out there. And anything we can do to help someone get into those fields, I think, is a good effort. And so I commend you to the bill. On and for the bill.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I understand and appreciate my two colleagues and about the need for certain people with career and technical training. But when you look at the bill, let's see what the bill does. It doesn't talk about giving money to the colleges to help. It says the bill shall go to approved career and technical training provider. Well, who is that? Is that, in fact, the college? You know, we have a lot of programs in place right now that the college administer. I know there's a very successful one over in Sweetwater County that's funded by the private sector. Go talk to your private sector people that are looking for these kind of career people, and what they do, there's a lot of federal grants that are available. You bring them into your own office, your own business, you train them, you teach them, you get credits through the federal program. I'm just trying to figure out, you know, who's really going to be training who here. And we already have several good programs that are working over there at Workforce Services. Anyway, the last thing, and I have a question for the Education Committee members, what about the Hathaway, if they're going to go to the colleges? And I think we've had a lot of debate about the Hathaway. Don't we provide money in there if they want to have career and technical training through the colleges? And that's probably the way to do that. So I'm not sure who's going to provide what to whom in this bill.
Senator Ron Flatter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The providers are, the Wyoming Workforce Service has a Workforce Council, and which I'm a member of is the Senate rep for that. And they have a list of qualified providers, and that's who would be providing this. And as far as the Hathaway, that was a great debate about giving more money than the Hathaway Scholarship would for any for the lowest section of the Hathaway, the lowest tier. And it was decided that this fits a group of people that do not qualify, 98% of them do not qualify for Hathaway. You remember, there was so many years after you got out of school, you had to use the Hathaway, and it was only good for 8 semesters at that point. So this takes care of that next group of people that have gone past that moment and need training, need to upgrade themselves. They're not being paid for by their company. It states right in the bill that if there's money that pays for it first, like we're not alleviating or supplanting some company's training program, this is fresh new money. If they're paid to upgrade their electrical license or something like this, or they're starting out in as a helper, working their way up the scale, and the company is buying that, this has nothing to do with that. We're not going to go in there and give them money and tell the company they don't have to put their money in it. But it'll be the Workforce Council, the pre-approved Workforce Service providers are all qualified and have been vetted prior to this moment. We're not competing with Hathaway because it's a group of people that are beyond that couple of years out of that you're allowed to use your Hathaway scholarship. And then after that, you're on your own. It's for those. And we're not supplanting company money because if the company has a training program, they still pay themselves. This is for that other group that finds themselves washing dishes and wants to become an electrician's helper to work their way up the scale. That's what this is meant for. It is not meant for a company program.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bevout.
Well, Mr. Chairman, tell me about an apprentice electrician. And when you go out into that field and you're paid a lower salary and you're trained while you're doing it, so now are we going to provide that union with these funds to train people that they're already training anyway? I mean, I don't understand that, and that's what are we doing here with providers? Maybe the question is, who are these providers? You could provide me with that list.
Senator Von Flatter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It has nothing to do with unions. Let's get that straight. But there could be an oil field electrician helper, and he realizes that, you know, there's a downturn coming on, and now he needs to get upgraded or learn some more electrically, so-and-so commercial or so-and-so residential electrical company would hire him. So he's got to do that on his own. I mean, his own oil field company, whether they're working them 10 hours or 50 hours this week and maybe none next week and maybe 100 the next week, they're not about to pay him to go get his upgrade so he can get a consistent paycheck. He's got to go do that himself. This is where he could apply. This is what he would do. This does not take the place of any kind of, as I said, already in place company and or union apprentice program. This is for that individual to apply. Workforce Services, I can provide you on second reading. I'll send them a quick email. We have a whole list of providers that are already pre-vetted and qualified to provide this type of training. So I'll get that list for you.
You're ready for the question. All those in favor of Senator Von Flatter's motion that the Committee of the Whole rise and report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 121, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion passes. Senate File 121 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Mr. Chairman, I move the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
What is Haley's name?
You've heard the motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
Would the reading clerk please read the Committee of the Whole report?
Mr. President, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. Senate File 136, do pass amended. Senate File 95, do pass. Senate File 122, do pass. Senate File 67, failed to pass Committee of the Whole and was indefinitely postponed. Senate File 138, do pass amended. Senate File 121, do pass. Senate File 104, failed to pass Committee of the Whole and was indefinitely postponed. Senate File 138, do pass amended, and Senate File 121, do pass. Senator Hicks, Chairman.
Chairman Hicks.
Mr. President, I move for adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You've heard the vote or the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The Committee of the Whole report has been adopted. Messages
from the House?
Messages from the House.
February the 5th, 2015, from the House of Representatives, message number 238, Committee of the Whole indefinitely postponed. The House adopted the Committee of the Whole report failing the bill listed below by the vote indicated. House Bill number 203, Livestock Brand Reciprocity, ayes 13, noes 47. The bill has been indefinitely postponed. House Bill number 28, Investigative Subpoenas, ayes 1, noes 58, excused 1. The bill has been indefinitely postponed. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Do you have any standing committee reports? That clears the desk. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk. Oh, Senator Peterson.
Mr. President, I apologize. I missed a re-referral. Senate File 96, Special Investigator. I would ask that bill be re-referred to the Appropriations Committee, Committee Number 2. It had a fiscal note.
Without objection, Senate File 96 is re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that does clear the desk.
Thank you, Mr. President. Before I make the announcement, may I have the privilege of the floor?
You may.
Thank you, Mr. President. Just a reminder to members of the Senate that tomorrow, Friday the 6th, is the last day for bills reported out of committee in the House of Origin. Monday will be the last day for Committee of the Whole in the House of Origin. And then on Wednesday and Thursday, we will initiate the discussion on the Committee of the Whole for the supplemental budget bill. With that, Mr. President, I move that the Senate stand adjourned until 9:30. A.M. tomorrow, Friday, February 6th.
9:30. Announcements, Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Mr. President, your committee number two, Appropriations, will meet tomorrow noon, immediately upon noon recess at lunchtime, to undertake to hear the following bills. Senate File 128, Election Runoffs, and Senate File 96, Special Investigators.
Extra special. Senator Scott.
Mr. President, your Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. in the normal committee room. House Bill 57, Engrossed, Health Insurance Medical Necessity Reviews, and we'll start on House Bill 58, Developmental Disability Service Transition Grants. We'll take to the extent time permits, and it will now permit a half hour less than we expected, but we'll take presentation and public testimony and then lay it back till Monday.
Senator Emmerich.
Mr. President, your committee number 5, Agriculture, State, and Public Lands and Water Resources, will meet in about 5 minutes in room S-15 to take up House Bill 8, Landowner Indemnification, and House Bill 70, Engrossed Omnibus Water Bill Construction.
Senator Von Flatern.
Thank you, Mr. President. Number 9, Minerals and Economic Development Committee will meet tomorrow about 20 minutes after noon recess on room S-18 to discuss Senate File 135, Misclassification of Employees Penalties, and House Bill 55, Engrossed Solid Waste Program Amendments.
Senator Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your number 1 committee, Judiciary, will meet Friday morning, tomorrow at 8 o'clock, room S-1. To discuss House Bill 14, Electric Citations, House Bill 15, Engrossed Restoration of Voting Rights by the Department of Corrections, House Bill 16, Offenses Against Public Administration, House Bill 17, Engrossed Sexual Assault Protection Orders, and House Bill 18, Engrossed Drone Protection Act.
Are there any more announcements? There being none, you've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion has been adopted. The Senate shall stand adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow, Friday, February 6th.